Gail, where are you? Where's Gail? Thank you. Thank you for sharing the gospel through your story. And I am excited to be here this morning. I have to tell you, I was joking with the leadership team this morning. I said, I worked really hard to figure out how to land this thing. So if we're still circling at the end of the morning, I just apologize. but with that, let me just pray again. Father, we thank you. We thank you that we get to be here, that we have your word, that we can study it, that we can understand who you are, that we can understand who we are called to be in light of who you are. Father, I just thank you for the life of Paul. I love how Gail said, he's in heaven. Remind us that these are people who live just like us in the flesh and blood, and they sought to honor you with every ounce of what they had. God, we want to be those type of people. And so we know this is the work that only your spirit can do. So we ask your spirit to do just that work this morning. Lord, if there are things you want to convict us of, if there are things you want to open our eyes to, we ask that you would do that. We ask that you would come and just be moving and allow us to see you through your word this morning. I pray this in your name. Amen. I'm realizing I could use water. If anybody would mind getting me water, that would be great. I don't want to sound like this the whole time. So that was already starting. Okay. I want to share with you a little bit of a story, kind of as an intro. Two summers ago, Jesse and I decided to do some fishing. I live in Woodbridge, and so we have a lake not too far from. Who else lives in Woodbridge? Let's just shout out to Woodbridge. Whoop whoop. Okay. I live in Woodbridge, and we have the lakes that aren't too far. And I actually have had this fishing. Thank you so much, Gina. Gina is my office mate. If you didn't know that, she's amazing. And here she comes through for me with water. I'm going to open this up. Hold on. Okay, excuse me. Hopefully that's better. Two summers ago, I decided, you know what? Let's try something new. I had this fishing permit on my Woodbridge, ID that I had never used. And I'm like, I want to use that thing. And the funny thing is, when I had graduated from graduate school, this is random, but Drake's dad had gotten me fishing gear and a fishing pole. This was back in 98 that I had never used. So they had just been sitting in my garage. And finally, I was like, I have a fishing permit. I have a lake. I have a dog. And let's do this. So we gather, and he had given me all sorts of bait and lures and fake crickets and all these things. Who knows whether they were super old by that point, but I don't fish, so I don't know. I'm trying this. So we go to the lake, and we kind of went probably, I would say, several nights in a row, maybe 4 or 5 nights in a row. That's what we were doing right at the as twilight was coming in. And so we're fishing, and I'm like getting all excited. This is going to be awesome. We're going to catch some fish. It's catch and release. Well, first night, nothing. Second night, nothing. I'm thinking, okay, I'm using everything I've been given here, and this is not working. But we kept doing it because there was something actually really lovely about it, even though we weren't catching fish. Well, I'll say lovely for me. Jessie got to the point where she's like, what are we doing? There's nothing happening here, Mom. So finally, it's really interesting. There's this little boy and his dad who had been kind of fishing every night around the same time at the lake. And finally, they came over to us and they're like, you're not catching anything, are you? And we're like, nope. He said, well, that's because you're using the wrong bait. And so he proceeds to tell us we needed live bait. And so we had to be cutting worms and doing all of this. Well, they told us, hey, look, we'll let you borrow some of our bait. And I'll tell you, that night it made all the difference. And Jessie caught her first fish within 5 minutes, by the way, after we used the right kind of bait. So this is two summers ago. And then this is the little boy who was helping her out. She was a little squeamish about it, but he helped her catch her first fish. Now, I tell this story, and I'm going to tell you there's a part of this analogy that absolutely makes me cringe, so I'm just going to say that. But I tell you this story because as we're talking about Paul and engaging culture, What Paul was doing as he shared the gospel is he was understanding, I hate using this word, this is where it breaks down for me, the right bait or lure. because I don't want it to sound like that. I don't want it to be bait or lure. But he knew the food that the people needed. And each group that he talked to, he understood what it was that was going to help them understand the gospel. And so in this analogy, this boy understood what we needed to catch those fish. We did not. But what we want to do as we engage culture is we want to be people who understand what the people need. What is the food that their soul actually needs? So I'm going to give you a little history. I'm going to move this so that we don't have to look at him catching fish. I'm going to give you a little history about what's happening as we lead up to this passage in Athens. Paul had his ministry that he was doing in Thessalonica, and there was a mob, right? He deals with this a lot. There was a mob that forced him out of the city, okay? And when he left that city, he went to Berea. And in Berea, he was having a really, what they would say, people were being very responsive to the gospel, as she shared. And it was a really sweet ministry that he had there. However, the troublemakers in Thessalonica heard about that, and they're like, mm-mm-mm. So they actually went to Berea and tried to stir people up, and had Paul had to end up fleeing quickly to get out of there, and had a hasty departure because they were stirring up the crowds against him. So Paul then goes to Athens, which is where we find ourselves in this passage, and he was awaiting the arrival of Silas and Timothy, who were with him in Berea and had not yet come. So he fled on his own. He's waiting for them in Athens. And just to give you some idea about Athens, it's a population probably of about 10,000, not very many. And it was since the war in Rome, which was in 146 BC, it was an impoverished country. Or city. They were poor, but what's interesting is because of all that had flourished, they were still this center for philosophy, architecture, art. They were known for these things, okay? But what's also interesting is that every house had several shrines. Like, that was just kind of a known part of their culture, all these shrines. And then what I read was that there was actually one god, lowercase g, that would be this head of Hermes that was in the front of every home, okay? So they had, this was pretty just pervasive. One might say it was a forest of idols. Just everywhere you turned, there were these man-made idols to all sorts of different lowercase gods. So then we find ourselves in this passage. And Paul comes to Athens, and he immediately is distressed. It says he's truly distressed, like he's grieved in his soul. He's heartbroken when he looks around and he sees all of these idols, okay? And it says he then went on to reason day by day with anyone who would have a conversation with him. He was talking, it says, to pretty much anybody who would listen. Paul was like, let's have a conversation. And interestingly, this is a town that the philosophy was big, so they liked talking about ideas. So he got to talk to people a lot in the marketplace and all of these other places. And so what's interesting is there were two philosophers that began to debate with him. One, it says, was Epicurean, and the other was Stoic. These were pagan philosophers. They were polytheists, again, believed in several lowercase gods. And just to give you some background, Epicureans, and this is just brief, there's whole things written about this stuff, but they believed that reality is basically endless chance. Everything's just kind of a dispersion of atoms. So they would find the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ absolutely laughable. There was no place for that in their philosophy. The Stoics believed that fate governs all. So anything that was purposeful or a God who saw over was totally foreign to them as well. And so they kept saying, what is he saying? Is he describing some foreign god, lowercase god? I keep saying that, but I feel like it's an important distinction. What is he saying? What in the world is he talking about? And I love this. This is one of my favorite verses in the passage. Verse 18 says, Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. That's what he was doing. The good news about Jesus and the resurrection. That's all that Paul was about. So then we come and they basically say, well, we want you to explain this stuff. So then we come to what's called Areopagus or Areopagus. I don't know. There's, well, Areopagus. Let's say that. Oh, there she is again. Okay. And this is actually, Areopagus is a rocky hill. It was 375 feet tall. This is actually it. AKA known as Mars Hill. And it was not far from the marketplace where Paul was having all of this conversation. Now, what's interesting to note is there was also an Areopagus council. So they met on this rock. And so it's referring to both these things. As this council actually was meeting, they were the legislative and judicial court of that city. And it was the highest court. They dealt with civil things, criminal things, and they dealt with religious matters. And basically what they would do is they would say, yes, you can speak that, or no, you can't speak that. So Paul was going to go to them and say, this is what I'm telling people. And they were going to basically decide, yes, you can share that, or no, that's not a legitimate philosophy, so get out of here. So they had this ability to basically license ideas, which is interesting. So Paul's hearers, these people wanted to see whether or not he should have the freedom to continue to teach. And they were saying, you're talking about strange things. Please explain. And I love it. Paul's looking for every opportunity to do just that. But one of the things I want to note, I love the way Luke writes. He actually has a parenthetical statement there. And he says, they love doing nothing and just discussing ideas. And I was like, I just love that. It's like, and by the way, these people love doing nothing. They just liked to discuss ideas. So they're saying, explain this to us. And Paul's thinking, yes, I can't wait to explain this to you. Paul notes what he had observed in their culture. And what I want to point out is that required effort. Paul made an effort to understand their culture and observe some things. He observed that their religiosity or their religiousness is that they were worshipers. They were just worshipers of false gods. And he then says that he noted an altar that they had with an inscription that said, to an unknown god. And what's beautiful is Paul then takes this piece of their culture and he uses it to share the gospel with them. He says, you don't know this God that you're worshiping? Let me tell you about this unknown God. Let me make him known to you. And then Paul proclaims the gospel to them. And I love what he shares about this unknown God. He gives these truths about who God is. And these are just things for us to just glean. Who is this God that we love and serve? And here are those truths. In verse 24, he's basically saying, God is the creator of the entire universe. There is nothing here that can be contained by anything. Wait, he cannot be contained by anything established by human hands. And basically he's saying all of your false gods are established by human hand. God is the creator of the universe and nothing can be contained by him that is established by human hands. Verse 25 says God is the sustainer of life. It's basically saying he doesn't need anything. We need him. He doesn't need anything. We need him. Then in verses 26 through 29, God is the ruler of all nations and the father of mankind. And basically he's saying all nations, all peoples are subject to him. Whether we realize it or not, we are all subject to him and we come from him. He's the father of all mankind. We actually come from him. Then lastly, he says, God is the judge of the world, and he calls them to repentance. What's cool is then Luke actually shares with us the response that people had to Paul's message. And he says, some responded with sneering. Like, that's pretty harsh. When we see sneering in an audience, that's pretty gnarly. Others wanted to hear more. Tell us more. It's like their appetite was wet and they wanted more. More of that food. He knew how to serve them. And then some, it says, actually believed. And Luke points out two people, and I'm going to tell you right off the top, I don't know why he pointed out these two in particular. I tried to find that information and nothing was really clear to me. But he points out two people, Dionysus, who was a member of the Areopagus Council. Okay, so that was the first one. And the other one was a woman named Damaris. We'll say Damaris. And they're not totally sure who she was. She would not have been part of the council because women weren't part of the council. But she could have been a courtesan, which is actually a high status prostitute. But high status. So like, right? Right? Those don't go hand in hand for us, but... That's beautiful, right? High status prostitute. Or the other was that she was just a foreign follower of the Stoics, and she happened to just be present there. So those are some different things I read about her. But what I love is that it's important to Luke that he points out that a woman believed and that had an impact, because she wouldn't have been pointed out if she didn't have an impact for the gospel in the future. It says there were a number of others also who believed. And why did he name those two again? I'm not sure. So we have to ask ourselves, if you hear, this is Mars Hill, you'll hear people talk about Mars Hill, they'll say this was such a masterpiece of communication from Paul. And I think we have to ask ourselves, why is this such a masterpiece of communication? Why, what did this have to it that we can observe? And the first is, Paul observed his audience. He knew exactly who he was talking to. He understood them. He had sought to understand them in great depth. One of the parts of the passage even said he quoted a poem of theirs as he was sharing the gospel. He had to know their poetry and actually be able to quote it, okay? So he fully understood his audience. He sought to know what they cared about. He sought to understand what this audience cared about. He was engaging people in their context. He wasn't saying, hey, for me to share with you, you got to come do it my way. He went right into their context of just kind of ideas and this council and all these things. And he's like, I'm going to engage you in your context and the way that you flush out ideas. He provided the type of food that these fish needed. He made God known in a way that they could understand. And in doing so, he absolutely revealed the character of God. Paul had different ways of sharing the gospel, which we'll see throughout Acts, but we already saw when we studied Acts 13, 16 through 41, that Paul, when he was sharing with the Jewish people, he shared out of the context of Israel and their longing for the Messiah and saying, Jesus is the Messiah that you're longing for. And so it was a completely different way of approaching the gospel. But what I want to point out is Paul's message was always the same. It was Jesus is the resurrected Lord. His message never changed. From beginning, the way that he got to the council was he was preaching Jesus. What he did with the council is he preached Jesus. What he did after the council is he preached Jesus. Beginning, middle, end, Jesus Christ is Lord, and he is the resurrected Lord. That is something that I think is really important. His message never changed. The way that he engaged that message with people was adjusted based on who they were. Do you know what? Jesus did the same. We're not going to go into this. There's so many things I could point out where Jesus knew who he was talking to, whether it be a group of people or an actual individual, and he shared who he was and revealed truth so based on his knowledge of those people and so understanding what they needed, what the food was that they needed for their soul. And when he talks about the kingdom of God is like, and he goes into all these pictures that they could understand from their culture. Okay, Jesus did that very well. I'm going to share with you a story that is a little bit more modern story. There was a missionary couple. This will be, I think, a familiar story to many of you. There's a missionary couple, Don Richardson, and I can't remember his wife's name. But they had committed to go to the Sawi tribe, which was in Dutch New Guinea, and it was basically an unreached people group. And this tribe, they were cannibalistic headhunters, okay? This was a violent group of people, and they did violent, violent things. And they were very isolated from the modern world. And this couple had a heart to go and reach them. And basically, they spent 8 years learning the language, trying to understand who they were, getting to know their culture, so on and so forth. They began to share. There were many cultural barriers, by the way. And there were times when they said it seemed absolutely impossible. How in the world are we going to share with these people? And even the fact that once they were starting to share the gospel, they shared about Judas and Jesus. And he was baffled because they came away from hearing that story going, Judas is the hero of this story. And they literally thought that because they're like, Jesus was the one who was duped by this guy. So they're heralding Judas is the hero. And he's going, oh my gosh, how do I ever, like, wow, what a miss, right? The other thing to note about this tribe is that they were constantly in these very violent battles with other villages nearby. And they were deadly battles, and they were happening regularly. And the Richardsons started to get discouraged, and they considered actually leaving the area. They just felt like their lives were in danger. It was a miss in terms of people even getting what they were trying to share after all this commitment. And then the people said, well, what can we do? They loved them. They actually liked having them there. What can we do to get you to stay? And the Richardsons said, we need peace. We need there to be peace between the villages. And they're like, okay, it was worth it to them. We're going to do what we can to bring peace. What then transpired over time was Richardsons started to observe this ritual that they had to bring peace. And it's profound. The ritual is that a family would actually give their child to the other village as an offering of peace. Right? Profound. I got chills just thinking about it. They would give up their child, and one time, Don observed this, and he had this moment where he had this epiphany. He goes, this is the redemptive analogy. This is the one that's going to help them understand, is that these people are giving up their own son to bring peace. That is exactly what God did. He used his child to bring peace. And I'll tell you, it was amazing. Jesus became known to them as the peace child, and lives were transformed in this tribe. Don Richardson saw something in this culture, and it took a lot of effort. He had to look and understand them. He gave his life to do that, that would help them. He ultimately saw something that would help them communicate the gospel to this group of people. This is just a quote from him. He said, using parallels or analogies from culture as illustrations does not mean we preach a different gospel in different cultures. It simply means that some of the most eye-opening and heart-unlocking illustrations may be culture-specific rather than universal. So then, that has to leave us with a question. What does this mean for us? I'm going to point something else out with Paul. He was so intentional about doing this. In fact, he has, in 1 Corinthians, he talks about how intentional he was. Sorry if that's small. I wanted to fit it all on one, but I know that's pretty small. Though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. Why? To win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but I am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak. to win the weak. I have become all things to all people so that all possible means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. Paul talks right here why he engages culture, and he says he did it in every way he possibly could because his message mattered. The good news of Jesus Christ resurrected. Paul's aim in understanding each culture was to win and save others. That was his aim. And then what I love is he says, and out of that, I get to partake in the best blessings and the benefits of the gospel myself. By doing this, by engaging culture and sharing the good news of Jesus Christ with all of these different people, I actually am benefiting. I'm experiencing the blessings of the gospel itself simply by doing this. I love that. Now, we could ask ourselves, was this just Paul's call or is this our call? Interestingly, the next chapter, Paul goes on, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he goes on to describe basically the same thing. I'm engaging with the Jews and understanding how Jewish culture is. I'm engaging with the Gentiles in the same way. Last line says, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. This is our call. We're supposed to do this. But here's my question. This is where it gets to us. Are we engaging culture, our culture, the American culture, for the sake of the gospel, or are we swept up in it? I have felt so convicted that when we are engaging culture, we're just right there in it. We don't look different. It doesn't look. We have engaged culture in such a way that we are swept right up in it. We've been called to be in the world, not of it. And I have to ask ourselves the question, would people look at the women in this room and say, I don't see a difference. I don't see a difference from the people outside this room. I think that would be heartbreaking. It is necessary to engage culture. It's part of our call, but it is dangerous. Cultural tides, and I want you to think about this. The cultural tides that we experience are intended, they are intended by the enemy to move us away from a deep allegiance to Jesus. That is the intent. All of these cultural shifts that we experience, and they've been happening since the beginning of time, but we're in some very thick ones right now. They are all intended to move us away from a deep allegiance to Jesus Christ. That is the enemy's intent. We have to, as believers, know the truth in such a way that it can cut through these tidal currents. We have to be cautious that it can absolutely engulf us, even as we're trying to engage culture and understand it. We have to be vigilant with our souls. John Piper puts it this way. He says that in many ways, being in culture is like being tossed into the ocean. And we are all tossed into the ocean. The question is, are we a jellyfish that goes with everything that comes and just moves as it is? Or are we a dolphin who's cutting through that current with intent and purpose? He's saying our call is to be the dolphins. We can't be jellyfish that look like everything else in the ocean and just move with every tide. We have to be dolphins that cut through that tidal current with purpose. Are we swept up in the current? I think about us and I go, what would be our idols if Paul was to show up here and he'd go, oh my gosh, this is a forest of idols. My heart is grieved. Would his heart be grieved? I think it might be actually. Do we have in some way this idol of Hermes at the front of our door and we don't even realize it? That we have these idols that are so pervasive that we don't even realize they're everywhere and we've surrounded ourselves with them. Is our spirit grieved like Paul when we see the idols of our culture? I'm going to just read some passages of scripture. I'm not going to say a lot about these. I just want them to sit with us. So let's just sit with some of these verses, okay? And allow the Holy Spirit to move as he will. Romans 12:2, do not be conformed to this world, Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. James 4:4. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. 1 Peter 1:18. You were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers. You were ransomed from these. 1 John 2:15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. And then Jesus said, I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. Keep them from the evil one. Christianity, we are as Christians supposed to engage the world. See, I'm giving you a preview of other things. Going back. We are called to engage the world, but we're called to engage the world the way that Paul did, with purpose, with the message of Jesus Christ. We're not called to engage the world to become like it. These scriptures are very clear what that means when we just become like the world. We're called to engage the world for the sake of the gospel. Christianity does not destroy earthly culture. I want to be really important. I want to be clear on this. We're not called to destroy earthly culture. We're called to be embedded right in it so that we can transform it. Our call is to transform it. I want to give you just, what do I have here? Okay, here are some ideas for things that we can consider. We want to be people who can spot falsehoods. This requires us to be vigilant. We want to be able to see myths and lies. And we want to be able to confront them with love and compassion and grace as Jesus would. Our call is to something greater than just being in this culture. Our call is to something far greater than that. Our call is to share the message of Jesus Christ, showing how the gospel can meet the deepest longings of the hearts of the people around us. You guys, we know the part of the story that people are longing for. And we want to be part of doing what Paul did to engage the culture and then share that. All right, I'll share Lauren Green. She's a correspondent. She's in the world, very much so. But this is what she says. Christians need to live with God as our living reality, not as a concept or an accessory that we mold to fit our lives. We must enter into the fog of a confused world as the light of Jesus Christ. And she's in a tough, she's a correspondent for a news organization. She's in a tough place doing that. Here are some questions I thought through that we could ask ourselves as we think about the culture around us. This can be questions we ask ourselves in conversation with people. It can be questions we ask ourselves when we're watching a movie. It can be questions. These are the types of things, if we're being vigilant in our soul, these are the types of things we should probably constantly be asking ourselves as we engage the culture around us. What is the worldview being espoused? If I'm talking to somebody who's not a believer, what is their worldview? What is their presupposition? What are they functioning from? What's the basis of their decision-making? What's driving how they make decisions? I think that's a really important thing. Like, what's driving somebody to make the decisions that they make? And we have to seek to understand that about people and understand that about our culture. How would this, whatever they're doing, how would this movie, how would this art, how would it look different if it was done as unto Christ? So then that helps us understand what is it that's amiss, right? How would it look different if it was done as unto Christ? Then we see what's the miss in it. Do you see cultural dynamics that can help you point people to the gospel story? That's exactly what happened with the peace child. That's exactly what Paul did. If we have our eyes open to the culture around us, we will begin to see these things that can help us point people to the gospel. to the message of Jesus Christ resurrected. And what are the longings? I think this is so important. What are the longings of the soul that people are expressing in whatever it is that can only be fulfilled through Jesus? We all have them. We all have those longings. And he says, I am the way. So what does this look like as we engage with people? It has to be done in love. We want to engage people for the sake of the gospel, and we have to keep our heart vigilant. I have two questions I want you to honestly ask yourself as you think about how you engage the world around you. Are you, as you engage the culture and the world around you, are you becoming, am I becoming, wordy, that's not what I intended, are you becoming more worldly minded or more spiritually minded? What's the movement that's happening in your soul? Secondly, is my passion for sharing the gospel and seeing loved ones embrace Jesus, is it growing or shrinking as I engage the culture around me? Where is my passion going? I just want to end by pointing out a couple things. I want to think through I'm going to note a few things in our culture that are just asides, but they so reflect this heart of longing for something more. I'm going to start out by just reading this quote from Russell Moore. We must learn to listen. Part of this is listening to what our culture is saying. We must listen beneath the popular factor, because there's all sorts of things that are just super popular. We've got to listen beneath that, on what's on the surface, to hear the fear, the discouragement, and the disillusionment of people. We've got to dig beneath the cynicism of men and women who are experiencing longings that only can be fulfilled in the reign of a Galilean carpenter king. So I'm going to actually read to you some things. We have a culture that loves superheroes. We've got a superhero, Superman, who came from beyond the stars to rescue humanity from itself. It's part of our culture. But what is it? What can it help point to? We've got a country music singer, Toby Keith, who sings about unity and diversity and how he longs for that in a song called I Love This Bar. I actually don't know the song, by the way. But unity and diversity is a biblical thing that comes through Jesus. You got trashy talk shows like Jerry Springer, right? But they always end in a moral lesson for the day. Why? Because people are longing for moral grounding. What's interesting is the entire rest of the show is like about the idea of no moral absolutes. There's no moral absolutes at all. But at the end, then we have this disconnect where then they want to lead us to some moral understanding at the end. Okay? Why? Because our souls long for that. Why do hip-hop artists sing about their rage against an absent father? Because having an absent father isn't good, even though we would live in a world that says that's fine, that's okay. We rage against that because we know in our soul we have a deeper longing for something more. In literature, film, music, these point to longings all the time. We just have to open our eyes to it and allow those to be an opportunity to engage people with the depth of their longing that they really have. Everyone longs for a story that makes sense of their world. Everyone longs for that. And I believe the gospel story is what they're ultimately longing for. And we can engage culture in such a way to reveal that story. The story they're longing for. Let me pray.